Hey guys, before we get into the podcast, I wanted to let you know that we're launching Barbell Medicine Plus so that we can expand on what we're doing with the podcast, the website, and beyond. Now, over the past 300 plus episodes, Dr. Baraki and I have tried our best to be one of your go-to resources for legit, evidence-based health and fitness information. But now, with your help, we want to do more. Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers will enjoy ad-free listening, and for nearly all of our episodes, receive access to an executive summary and an article, along with the transcript, a video version of the podcast, and exclusive access to a private forum to ask Dr. Baraki and I questions, which we'll answer on a monthly podcast that's released only to our subscribers. We'll be publishing other exclusive content for Plus members as well, and we've already uploaded a lot of resources for our subscribers and will continue to expand this offering. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. Thank you in advance for your support. Let's get into the episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 313. We're going to talk about excess cortisol or hypercortisolism. And to help us do that, we have the second most handsome doctor in North America. That's Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing all right. In another hospital stretch and had an exciting day taking care of, I think, 17 sick inpatients and did a lot of teaching, did some ultrasound, did a whole bunch of cool stuff today. So
if you had to predict your cortisol levels right now, if you had to estimate them, do you think they're like baseline? Do you think they're elevated? Do you think you're turned up? Like what's going on?
Well, not terribly elevated. I did just finish a bit of a workout. So whatever effect that might have, it's also late afternoon, early evening. So that has
should
a little
be
bit
towards
of a dip to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, probably all comes out in the wash and doesn't really matter.
I mean, honestly, yeah, let's just shut down the podcast. That's it. That's all you need to know. How long since you finished your workout? I could predict this.
About 20 minutes.
Right now, it's probably still above baseline when you like prior to thinking about starting. Although when you thought about starting, you know, exercise, it went up. But about 90 minutes, you're going to be back to baseline. And then tonight, here's the cool part. And we'll talk about this more when we talk about exercise's effect on cortisol. It's going to be lower than if you were an insufficiently active individual. It's like a compensatory response in those who are well-trained. And I think we can all agree that you're well-trained. So, you know, make sure you do that next time on teaching rounds when you get somebody with a cortisol aberration. All right. Well, let's transition into the bulk of this podcast. We're going to be talking about hypercortisolism, having too much cortisol on board. Now, Austin, did you listen to the last podcast I released, a little cortisol primer sort of thing?
I did.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, I mean, not that you needed it, you know about cortisol, but, you know, for the listeners at home, if you haven't listened to that, I'm going to spare you. I do want you to go back and listen to it. There's some really cool information on not only how does dieting or energy restriction affect cortisol levels, but also like the discovery of cortisol, which to me, that was the most interesting thing about this. Like the Luftwaffe pilots and like cow adrenal glands, like I assume for like a decade there, like the late 20s into the, you know, late 30s, there was like this black market sort of thing for cow adrenal glands. And like, you know, research facilities were trying to procure like tons of these things to make a compound E, as it were. Sidebar, did you watch the series The Boys on Prime?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Well, they have a compound V. And I'm like, well, is this the next one? Like, are we grinding up like something? Anyway. All right. So a little cortisol review here. So cortisol is a steroid hormone that is made in the adrenal gland. The adrenal gland is a small organ that sits on top of the kidneys, which are also called the renal gland. So adrenals on top of the renal glands. The outside part of the adrenal gland is called the cortex, which is broken up into three distinct layers or zones. The outer zona glomerulosa, that's where aldosterone is produced for water and salt regulation. The middle zona fasciculata, that's where cortisol is produced. And the inner layer, the zona reticulata, that's where sex steroids are made.
Now, cortisol production starts at the hypothalamus, where corticotropin-releasing hormone, or CRH, is released secondary to stress, which can be physiological or psychological, as well as real or perceived. From there, CRH, or corticotropin-releasing hormone, travels to the anterior pituitary gland and tells it to release another hormone, this one called ACTH, which stands for adrenocorticotropic hormone. ACTH is then dumped into the bloodstream and travels to the adrenal gland, where it stimulates the adrenal gland to start making hormones, aldosterone and cortisol, as well as catecholamines, that's noradrenaline and adrenaline, plus a little bit of dopamine. Now, each anatomical area of the adrenal gland has special enzymes that help them make specific hormones and add another level of regulation for fine-tuning this response to stress. Now, once made, cortisol binds to its receptor in the cytoplasm of the cell, and then the sort of cortisol and its receptor enters the cell nucleus and does most of its work by affecting the type and amounts of proteins that the cell makes through DNA transcription and protein synthesis after RNA translation. Now, increased cortisol levels return to basal levels by a sort of feedback inhibition, negative feedback loop, where the hypothalamus, the prefrontal cortex, and other areas in the brain, well, they get the signal that the stress is gone and or has been adequately dealt with. And so the cascade that stimulates cortisol release, well, it stops going. The elevated levels of cortisol in the body also tamp down further once it's sufficient. So all told, both reduce stress signaling and elevated cortisol levels. Together, they both reduce the production of CRH by the hypothalamus and ACTH by the pituitary gland. And so if we wrap all this together, the production and regulation of cortisol depends on the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, also known as the HPA axis. Now, cortisol levels change throughout the day, both having a circadian and ultradian rhythm. For the circadian rhythm, cortisol is highest in the morning for most people. It's around 8 a.m. That's why you do a morning cortisol level if you want to test it. And then it decreases to the lowest point, also known as the nadir or the trough, right around bedtime, about 10 p.m. The ultradian rhythm is layered on top of this, where there are about 8 to 10 pulsatile peaks of cortisol over the course of the day, mostly for fine-tuned control of the actions of cortisol. So now with that background, we can talk about what happens when there's too much cortisol on board. Now, Austin, when you're in the hospital, I assume you never get a page or a call for, hey, we got a suspicion of excess cortisol in this patient. Can you come down and like confirm or deny that? You like probably never get that call directly, but you might hear a sort of sign out or a patient story that kind of clues you into, hey, they might have some excess cortisol on board. How does that phone call usually go?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that for me in that setting, much more concerning and life-threatening in the short term is insufficient cortisol or adrenal insufficiency, which we've talked about a bit before. Cushing's syndrome or excess cortisol is almost exclusively an outpatient diagnosis, meaning that it's something that tends to manifest with symptoms that are not very acute most of the time, much more chronic. It could be something as simple as like somebody just having unexplained hypertension and some, you know, body fat changes and things like that. And so that's something that is usually, it can be challenging to diagnose, but it is much more an outpatient diagnosis. I struggle to think of a particular occasion where I have been the person to make this primary diagnosis in the hospital. It might have happened once or twice, just out of suspicion from the whole syndrome that somebody has. Maybe they came in due to diabetic ketoacidosis, and that was the trigger for me to work up, like, why are their, you know, blood sugar like so crazy? They didn't have a history of, you know, known worsening diabetes, something like that to trigger me to chase it. But way, way, way more often, I'm thinking about low adrenal function than I am too much.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of like the last case that we had when the patient did have elevated cortisol levels, hypercortisolism due to a Cushing's disease. Effectively, the only reason he got to the hospital is because his weakness had gotten so bad. And yeah. So the rheumatologist was like, hey, we need to admit you to either figure out the correct care that you need because you're insufficiently managed right now based on your current medication regimen, or there's something else going on and we got to work that up. But the weakness was why they showed up, and that happened to be due to a severe case of excess cortisol, that case, Cushing's disease. So we're going to give you a lay of the land, dear listeners, about Cushing's syndrome, and Cushing's disease is a specific type of Cushing's syndrome. So Cushing's syndrome is defined as a prolonged increase in cortisol levels that is not due to a normal physiological response. And we'll talk about some of those with respect to diet and exercise and so on. So sure, if you get stressed out in the short term, your cortisol levels are going to go up, although not to the level that we typically see in Cushing's, and certainly for not as long. Okay. Even under the worst of times, the idea that you're going to get this like acquired Cushing's syndrome from like just run-of-the-mill stress, highly unlikely. And so if that's what you've been sold by somebody who says, you got to get your cortisol levels under control because you're developing this acquired Cushing's syndrome due to stress, highly unlikely. Highly unlikely. I'm not going to say impossible because look, anything is possible with humans. We do some interesting stuff, but that is highly unlikely. The most frequent cause of Cushing syndrome is exogenous, so outside the body, steroid use. So somebody who's on prednisone, for example, or a steroid like that for a long period of time, particularly at high doses, that can cause Cushing syndrome. And that is probably the most common cause of Cushing syndrome. The estimated incidence of Cushing syndrome due to endogenous overproduction, so the body overproducing it, overproducing cortisol, ranges from about 2 to 8 cases per million people annually. And that was actually a recent review published in JAMA. When the excess cortisol is due to an ACTH-producing pituitary tumor, as we saw in our last case, that's called Cushing's disease, not just syndrome. It's a specific type of Cushing syndrome. And if you're a med student right now and you're going to be, you know, entering your third year clerkships, that is a like pimp question that you are likely to get. And if you said Cushing syndrome when it's Cushing's disease or Cushing's disease when it's Cushing syndrome, oh, your knuckles are going to be, you know, somebody's going to wrap you on your knuckles. I don't know why doctors do that. Like, you got to the right answer, but it's more like it's either the wrong eponym or the wrong sort of like specific thing. Why do we do that? What's wrong with us?
Yeah, I think those two conditions just need different names. I mean, it is worth differentiating them because you do very different things for them, but naming them the same thing is cruel.
Yeah, it's like, what is it? Pseudo hypoparathyroidism. And then there's like pseudo, like there's come up with a different name. Just, yeah, you know, pick some other person to name it after or whatever. Yeah. All right, as far as symptoms of Cushing's syndrome, in general, the symptoms and signs of Cushing's syndrome result directly from chronic exposure to excess glucocorticoid like cortisol, and they vary by patient due to the degree, so how high they're elevated, and the duration of hypercortisolism. So, and if there's any co-occurring androgen excess, so sometimes you can get people who have high cortisol and high levels of things like DHEA or testosterone or other sort of metabolites, which is particularly problematic in women. The cause of the hypercortisolism, is it a tumor or, for example, I really wish we could clip the kindergarten cop thing. It's not a tumor like that, but I'm afraid of intellectual property and DMCA taking this down and so on. Main symptoms of hypercortisolism from Cushing syndrome include high blood sugar, so hyperglycemia, elevated protein breakdown, producing weakness and chronic muscle wasting, immune system suppression, so people can get these opportunistic infections or get infections they'd otherwise be able to fight, high blood pressure, weight gain, particularly body fat gain, also neurocognitive changes and mood disorders. And so we'll run through a little list by systems here. So with respect to the endocrine system, you can get menstrual irregularities due to the suppression of gonadal function from the hypothalamus due to excess cortisol or if you were taking a lot of glucocorticoids for some other condition. You could also get androgen excess signs. So like hirsutism, virilization, oily skin, those things can pop up as well effectively if your adrenal gland is being told to overproduce everything, for example, and which includes cortisol. It's also going to be producing a lot more sex steroids too. And so you can get midline hair growth if you're a woman, for example. You can get voice changes. You can get skin changes, all sorts of stuff. In the skin, individuals with elevated cortisol levels that are, again, far too high for far too long, they can bruise easily. Effectively, there's atrophy of the connective tissue under the skin. They can get striae, which are purple streaks in the skin because thin skin does not hide color of the venous blood underneath. You can get skin atrophy. You can also get hyperpigmentation with elevated ACTH if you have a particular cause of Cushing's syndrome that produces high levels of ACTH. Well, that binds melanocyte-stimulating hormone receptors, which are involved in, you guessed it, creating skin pigmentation. So have you seen a patient like that come through the door with hyperpigmentation due to an ACTH-producing tumor or something like that?
No, ACTH-producing tumors are very uncommon in general. So when I've seen hyperpigmentation, it's been more from Addison's disease, where the ACTH elevation is appropriate from the feedback standpoint for low cortisol levels, not from high, from a Cushing's disease. Never seen
what that. What color is that act? Because I've never seen it in real life. I've only seen it in a textbook. So like, what color is that?
Yeah,
they say hyper.
They get a sick tan.
Okay, yeah. So you might be thinking, man, I haven't been spending much time outside, but boy, yeah. I'm tan.
It depends on how long it's been going on before they come in. I mean, you can sometimes see it under the tongue. There can be some pigmentation there, you know, with the nails, other areas of the skin, things like that. It's not usually super dramatic these days because people tend to come in sooner and get checked out before, you know, it's not like it's been going on for decades.
Yeah. And they're like, I don't know, man, I've been tan for 10 years. I don't know what to say. Yeah. I live in North Dakota. What do I do? Metabolic signs and symptoms of hypercortisolism, Cushing's syndrome. The first thing that's going to come up and likely a question you're going to get asked, especially if you're in the medical field, is, you know, what happens to blood sugar? And it's hyperglycemia. Basically, elevated gluconeogenesis, your liver's pumping out a bunch of new sugar and breaking down a lot of the sugar that it has stored. And so your blood sugar levels go up. You get hyperglycemia. You also get insulin resistance due to decreased insulin release secondary to cortisol being overproduced or taken in too much if you're taking an exogenous steroid. You get progressive obesity, and we're going to cover the reasons why for that a little bit later, but that tends to present with this sort of central adiposity, so the face, the neck, the trunk, the abdomen, where people have really thin extremities and sort of this very rotund, very centralized obesity. They get fat accumulation in the cheeks and the temporal region of the skull. Sometimes that's called a moon face, and they also get a buffalo hump on the upper back, which is not only fat tissue, but also water storage on the upper back. And again, the extremities are small. Sometimes they can actually get fat that accumulates in the spinal canal. Now, I went down the rabbit hole trying to find out, like, do people ever get like neurological signs from excess fat accumulation in the spinal canal? And sure enough, yeah, they can, but it's pretty rare, you know, pretty rare. Also, I found some case reports of people who had like, it almost seemed like a incidental finding that they had some a milder form of Cushing's, and they exercised like extensively to regulate their weight despite having sort of elevated cortisol levels. As far as sleep goes, sleep apnea can result as a function of the increased adiposity and possible myopathy of the airway muscles, so the strap muscles of the neck, which I guess makes sense if you think about it, but also I don't know that I would suspect, you know, somebody presenting with sleep apnea. I'm like, hey, do you have Cushing's? And so I actually went to some of the current guidelines for like working up sleep apnea, and that is really not a consideration unless some other stuff is going on. Cardiovascular system, there's an increased risk of heart attack, stroke, which are both the primary causes of increased mortality that was seen in Cushing's. The higher risk of heart disease is secondary to not only an increase in risk factors, so like blood pressure tends to go up, people's lipids tend to go crazy, so higher levels of LDL and other atherogenic lipoproteins, but they're also hypercoagulable. So there's an increased risk of having a blood clot. It's about 18 times higher than the general population. And interestingly enough, they also have an increased risk of bleeding due to skin atrophy and the fragility in the capillaries of themselves. What's most concerning here is that even after diagnosis, these like findings do not like correct automatically. They tend to correct a little bit over the next year, but they seem to have some sort of elevated risk that persists. So you could make a case for individuals with known Cushing's syndrome or Cushing's disease that you would want to like optimize their risks maybe even more stringently than somebody without this additional risk factor. From a musculoskeletal standpoint, the biggest thing that people are going to be interested in here is the muscle wasting. Now, we've known that glucocorticoid-induced muscle atrophy was a thing since pituitary adenomas overproduce ACTH. Well, it wasn't until the 1950s that we knew that exogenously administered glucocorticoids and ACTH promote protein breakdown in the muscle while simultaneously preventing muscle protein synthesis. So you get like the double from both ends here. You're breaking down more muscle and you're also not synthesizing as much muscle, particularly if you have elevated glucocorticoid levels like cortisol for too long. Again, this is not really like a short-term thing and tends to not happen as a function of like normal physiological stressors that people have. The first evidence that endogenous glucocorticoids like cortisol contributed to the process of muscle atrophy came in the observation that adrenalectomized animals failed to undergo muscle atrophy in response to fasting. So effectively, there are a number of animal models where they had their adrenal glands removed, and they were like, oh, well, what happens here? Which, you know, if you're listening to this and you're like, that sounds pretty cruel, well, there are working groups that agree with you and are actively kind of managing this. But it seemed, you know, they took the adrenal glands out of these animals and they made them fast. And you would normally expect a bunch of muscle breakdown in that case. And these animals without adrenal glands seemed to not break down any additional muscle tissue. Now, they weren't asked to do any activity, so that might likely would have changed things. But I also would not recommend that people who are like very afraid of atrophy, oh, I'm going on vacation, I don't want to lose any muscle mass, probably don't cut your adrenal glands out. I don't think that's a good idea there. Austin, do you agree?
Ill-advised in general, sometimes medically necessary, in which case you need a doctor to make sure you don't die afterwards from lack of cortisol. So.
Yeah. I guess the lack of blood pressure and blood sugar regulation would probably do you in first, but that'll get you. Interestingly, there's some evolutionary sense to the specificity by which what types of muscles are broken down first. Glucocorticoids have this particular predilection for inducing atrophy of fast twitch skeletal muscle fibers, while slow twitch muscle fibers and cardiac muscles are largely protected. It seems like fast twitch muscle fibers may be more expendable during times of stress, for example, whereas slow twitch muscle fibers maintain posture and respiration, and you're going to need your cardiac muscle to like keep doing its thing if you want to survive. The explanation for this discordance in atrophy comes from the differential expression of the glucocorticoid receptor density. So like how many receptors do these different muscle fibers have? Fast twitch muscle fibers have a large number of glucocorticoid receptors, whereas they're relatively few in slow twitch muscle fibers and cardiac muscle. There's also other mechanisms by which cortisol affects sort of muscle protein synthesis and muscle protein breakdown. That has to do with insulin signaling, also satellite cell sort of recruitment. So after you exercise, for example, your muscle protein synthesis rates tend to go up at some time, and you also tend to recruit more satellite cells. These are like, you can think of them as precursors to muscle fibers. You tend to recruit those to make basically build new muscle fibers. Well, if you have a bunch of cortisol on board, you don't get those satellite cells to be recruited. And there's more mechanisms that could be potentially involved as well. Ultimately, with high levels of cortisol that we see in Cushing's syndrome, that ultimately drives catabolism if it's excessive. Again, either you're making it endogenously, you're making too much cortisol, or you're taking too much cortisol. It inhibits muscle cell proliferation and differentiation, and you get decreased anabolic response by effectively limiting how much amino acids get transported to the muscle, so you get less muscle protein synthesis. To summarize, more muscle protein breakdown, less muscle protein synthesis from having too much cortisol on board. And so that's just from the muscle size itself. You get some muscle wasting. Now, a guy like you, Austin, or me, for example, we get a little bit of muscle wasting. We probably wouldn't actually have that much weakness that would be detectable on exam, especially for most providers. They'd be like pulling on us and we'd be like, yeah, whatever, dude, I'm stronger than you. If that was the only part of the story, but there's not, people get muscle weakness too because they become low in potassium. They become hypokalemic, and that electrolyte abnormality tends to severely decrease muscle force production. You can also get osteoporosis. That's bone loss due to increased bone resorption and decreased calcium absorption, which is a big problem with prolonged corticosteroid use like prednisone. So when you have a patient who's on steroids for a long period of time, which they may need to be for various conditions, particularly of the autoimmune variety, you have to kind of screen them more regularly for osteoporosis and potentially start them on other medications to combat that side effect.
Exactly.
For the immune system, cortisol is needed to produce energy for the immune response. So for example, when you become febrile or you have a fever, there's a 13% increase in metabolic rate for every 1 degree increase in temperature. And you also need to create more amino acids in this free amino acid pool in the body to make various proteins involved in the immune response. So overall, when you have too much cortisol on board, it tends to be immunosuppressive, which can be good if you're treating something like an autoimmune disease and you want to treat it by tamping down inflammation. But again, if it goes on for too long and at too high of a level, that can become problematic. From a psychological or psychiatric standpoint, there also have been correlations with increased cortisol and learning, memory, and sort of performance on IQ tests and stuff like that. But the bottom line here is that cortisol is essential for pretty much all bodily functions in one way or another. We die if we don't have enough of it. But sustained elevations beyond the normal ranges that you see with everyday stressors tends to cause problems across all of these bodily systems. And again, just to clarify, even if you are stressed, in your life, whether it's sleep deprivation, whether there's a financial hardship, so on and so forth, that does not tend to generate cortisol levels that are on par with Cushing's syndrome, right? It's still within normal range. And as long as your body is actually producing enough cortisol to deal with the stress, that's a good thing. Once it stops doing that, that's a much bigger problem than a slight elevation within normal range, which is what we typically see in people who have this sort of mild hypercortisolism due to stress.
Yeah, it reminds me of the conversation around blood sugar, especially now that people are using continuous blood glucose monitors, right? And they're seeing fluctuations in blood sugar within normal physiologic ranges and getting worried about them. When that's not really much reason for concern compared with fluctuations well outside of the physiologic range or that stay outside of the range that would diagnose you with diabetes. Here, it's a similar situation where cortisol is going to fluctuate within a physiologic range in response to stressors. And that itself is not necessarily a cause for concern. This is not to say that chronic stress is not a problem. It's, you know, definitely can be something that detracts from your health and harms you in other ways. But the ways that that happens, I would not attribute to the cortisol itself. It's the cortisol is necessary for you to, you know, get through and survive those things. But that's not where my focus is when somebody's dealing with chronic stress. So it's similar to those blood glucose fluctuations within a range, but if the cortisol is sustained well outside of that, kind of like when glucose is elevated, sustained outside of it, we call it diabetes. When it's sustained outside of it here, that's when we're worried more about a Cushing syndrome. So yeah, Cushing syndrome does not emerge from just, you know, stress.
As far as what causes elevated cortisol levels, hypercortisolism, or Cushing syndrome, well, Cushing's disease, which we described as this sort of specific type of Cushing syndrome, that's typically from a tumor in the pituitary gland producing too much ACTH. And so the adrenal gland gets too much signal to create cortisol, and then you get too much cortisol. So Cushing's disease, again, is pituitary gland pumping out too much ACTH, and that's 65 to 70% of all Cushing's syndrome that's not caused by exogenous glucocorticoid use. It's typically caused by a pituitary adenoma, so that's where the tumor is. It's in the pituitary gland. Again, there are other causes of Cushing's syndrome. So again, it can be iatrogenic, which basically means it's caused by a medication, in this case, glucocorticoids. Probably the most common, but seldom reported, sometimes factitious. There are also non-pituitary tumors that can pump out ACTH. This is less common, about 10 to 15% of cases. There are adrenal tumors, so a tumor in the adrenal gland itself. And then there are other ectopic tumors, so tumors outside of any of the system that can produce CRH. So that's corticotropin-releasing hormone. That's, again, very rare, less than 1%. Yes. Yeah, I agree. Cool. As far as incidence goes, because of the difficulties in the diagnosis and recognition of hypercortisolism, estimates of its exact prevalence and incidence are widely variable. Cushing syndrome due to endogenous overproduction of cortisol tends to range from 2 to 8 people or cases per million per year, whereas Cushing syndrome is 3 to 8 times more prevalent in women. So there seems to be a little disparity. There seems to be a little bit more prevalence in women in that case. Cushing's disease, again, from the pituitary tumor producing ACTH, is more common in ages 25 to 45 years old, whereas for older patients, they tend to have an ectopic cause of Cushing's syndrome. When we talk about treatment, it does depend on the cause, obviously, wherever the issue is in the system. If it's Cushing's disease, again, from that pituitary tumor that's producing too much ACTH, they typically are recommended for transsphenoidal surgery that just talks about the anatomy. So you go through the sphenoid bone in the skull and you take out the mass in the pituitary gland. Typically, folks will need multiple sort of hormone supplements afterwards to replace the pituitary gland that was excised surgically. And so medical therapy may need to be taken if surgery is delayed or otherwise contraindicated or unsuccessful. Radiation is another potential treatment, sometimes used adjunctively. People can have a bilateral adrenalectomy is an option, particularly for those who want to have kids. Effectively, if your pituitary gland is excised surgically, pregnancy and fertility are severely compromised. Pituitary irradiation is a second-line treatment for persistent or recurrent Cushing's disease, and there are other medications that are available as well. If the cause is due to an ectopic tumor, so something outside of the pituitary gland that's producing ACTH and or CRH, typically medication is the first line treatment, so mifepristone or mitotane. And if somebody has a primary adrenal disease, so something that's going on at the level of the adrenal gland itself, there are several different adrenal diseases that can cause Cushing syndrome. The approach to these patients generally directed at removing the affected adrenal gland or glands. But again, at this point, you're working with an endocrinologist, you're working with the surgeon, and they're kind of working you up to make sure that you're getting the right treatment. The course of individuals with Cushing's syndrome, well, the physical symptoms and signs tend to resolve gradually once they're treated appropriately over a period of about 2 to 12 months. Hypertension, osteoporosis, and glucose intolerance improve but may not disappear, and that risk of heart disease tends to stay elevated for a pretty long period of time, even with sort of risk factor optimization. So it's really important to achieve the correct diagnosis and make sure that these folks are adequately treated. Now, I did link the guidelines for sort of assessment of Cushing, assessment and treatment of Cushing's syndrome in the show notes. Now, Austin, I know that you can see the outline here, but are you surprised to learn that within those guidelines, there's no mention of physical activity or exercise, no mention of diet or sleep, sort of recommendations for like sort of life, a lifestyle approach to managing these folks?
I am not terribly surprised that that is absent, particularly if there's a very obvious localizable lesion that can, for example, be excised, then that's all you really need to talk about as it relates to, you know, the cause of that particular patient's syndrome. And then the rest, they would return back to being a person for whom all the general, you know, physical activity guidelines and nutrition guidelines and things like that would apply. So I don't, you know, I would view it as like these guidelines should include it if there are ways by which those things can directly impact the disease course. And so here, I suppose you could say that those things could impact the risks that they incur for if they have it, as far as bone density, cardiovascular disease, things like that. But the sooner you just diagnose it and treat it, then they can revert back to, you know, Gen Pop guidelines. That's probably why it's that way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my thought is that if we agree that once Cushing syndrome, or again, the specific type Cushing's disease is diagnosed and adequately treated, if we agree that some of the signs and symptoms persist, therefore elevating risk longer term, then I think it makes sense that like as part of like a patient-centered care, we should be recommending exercise. We should be recommending a health-promoting dietary pattern, sleep changes, et cetera, in order to sort of optimize their risk and improve their health trajectory.
Sure.
It doesn't even need to be like the whole section. You could just say, hey, look, also, we refer you to the current physical activity guidelines.
Yeah.
We refer you to the current dietary guidelines. These are important because of this persistent elevated risk. Is that
Yeah, I'm with
is that
you. Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, no, I think that's very reasonable.
Yeah, I just want to throw shade on guidelines whenever possible. As far as cortisol testing goes, because I know people who are listening to this, they're like, so should I get my cortisol level tested? And if so, like, what does the test look like? Which test should I pick? The answer to that is no, you shouldn't pick. The physician that you're working with to, you know, sort of investigate cortisol abnormalities should be determining this based on your presentation. And if there is no presentation that is, you know, synonymous or looks like, smells like, feels like elevated cortisol, I would not recommend any sort of direct-to-consumer testing, even though you can do that. So there's a lot of information on testing that I prepared. I am not going to recapitulate that to the group, to the audience, because again, I think it's we're going to lose a lot of people. But I will just say this. The cortisol levels tend to vary throughout the day, okay? They follow this diurnal variation. Peak values tend to be in the morning about 8 a.m., and they tend to be at the trough or the nadir, the lowest level, at about 10 p.m. In Cushing's syndrome, this sort of variation is lost, and the p.m. cortisol levels are inappropriately elevated. And again, on top of this diurnal variation, there are these 8 to 10 pulsatile peaks, also known as the ultradian sort of rhythm, layered on top of your circadian rhythm. So depending on when the blood is sampled to take a cortisol level, or if you used a different sort of test, there can be significant variation in the normal absolute values of cortisol and ACTH. That's why we just don't recommend going and getting one in the middle of the day. Probably not going to tell you much, although we don't recommend that folks go out and get their own cortisol tests on their own anyway. There is no single preferred diagnostic test for Cushing's syndrome, nor is there a consensus on how to decide whether and when to test, despite a lot of work being done on this particular topic. But when you're evaluating somebody with a hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, you're just trying to evaluate that axis in general. A static measurement, so a one-time measurement of these hormones, is not really useful. Again, due to the variable nature of cortisol and ACTH secretion in normal physiological states. in general, if one is suspicious of reduced function of the hypothalamic pituitary axis, then measurement of morning cortisol at 8 a.m. is when it's expected to be at its peak and is a good screening strategy. Now, if one is concerned by too much cortisol, like we see in Cushing's syndrome, an overproduction of cortisol or ACTH, then measurement of cortisol should be performed late at night when it's expected to be at its nadir or its trough. Alternatively, you could use a dexamethasone suppression test. We talked about that in our last case. And in all of these situations, if there's an abnormality that's found or an indeterminate finding, yeah, further testing could be necessary. But I just want to impress upon the listeners at home that there are many different ways to test cortisol. There's blood tests, there's hair tests, there's urine tests, there's salivary cortisol tests. And again, there's no like one specific one that seems to be the best or is the gold standard. In fact, on the guidelines that I linked in the show notes, they talk about all of these things and their sort of sensitivity and specificity, when to use them, when not to use them. And so if I wanted to make this podcast 3 hours, I could just read those to you or summarize them, but I'm not going to. Just need to know.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. As a reminder, you can support the podcast and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, where you'll get ad-free episodes, exclusive access to summaries and articles for each podcast, along with an edited transcript, a video version of the podcast, and exclusive access to a private forum to ask Dr. Baraki and I questions that we'll answer on a monthly podcast that's released only to our subscribers. Head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Now, Acorns is an investment platform, also have a bunch of educational tools on their website. I thought they had a pretty good product, so thought I would let them sponsor our podcast. They make it easy to automatically start saving and investing for the future. You don't actually need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can start with just your spare change. With Roundups, that's a program that they have to round up any purchase made from a linked account, debit or credit card to the next dollar. And that goes into your retirement or investment account. They also have Acorns Early, which is an investment account for kids. And they recommend an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Head over to acorns.com/BBM or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/BBM. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up. And according to the 2022 annual data breach report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the U.S. in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni. When it comes to big wireless providers, what you see is almost never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price that you thought that you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again. When Mint Mobile says $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, well, they mean it. You can say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at just $15 a month. Now, all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number, along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless plans with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for just $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. A $45 upfront payment is required, which is equivalent to $15 a month. This offer is only good for new customers on a 3-month plan only.
Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on an unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details. That if you are suspicious of a cortisol problem, 10 out of 10 would recommend consulting your physician and working together to figure out, do you need to be tested in the first place for the symptoms that you're describing, and let them and potentially other healthcare professionals determine how to adequately assess you. I think that's the best advice I can give.
Yeah, this is an area that is just rife with quackery out in the real world. You know, people will say for any symptom, if you feel bad, if you're tired, if you're stressed, whatever, it could be due to cortisol problems. And it's not to say that these can be entirely unrelated, but rather to the extent you see any cortisol derangements, even though there's plenty of lab variation and things like that, it could just be a consequence, right? It may not be the primary driver that you have Cushing syndrome leading to this, but rather it's like, did you need a test to tell you that you don't sleep well? Did you need a test to tell you that you have a lot of life stress? And working on those things is probably the better target instead of testing for these things and looking for numbers that attempt to quantify something that is not terribly quantifiable.
Yeah. And it's the same sort of thing because there is a range of sort of normal cortisol levels on all of these tests. And so The idea is someone's like, oh, well, I'm high normal or I'm like low normal. Like, what does that mean? And It's like shoulder
shrug. Don't know. Much. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So because the guidelines have no lifestyle sort of recommendations, I thought that we should talk about sort of the impact or the effects of different lifestyle changes on cortisol levels. And we'll start out with nutrition. If you listened to the last podcast, you got an overview of this. But now that we have the second most handsome doctor in North America on the other end of the line, I get to ask for his feedback here. So with respect to nutrition, most of the nutrition science field views dietary restriction, especially calorie restriction, as a stress on the body, which may have implications on hunger, weight loss trajectory, body composition, and more, all mediated by some sort of cortisol-related effect. The central paradigm here is that cortisol is one of the counter-regulatory responses to low energy availability, whether it's a few hundred calories or actual starvation. So we're going to go through a number of different sort of levels of low energy availability, and we'll get Dr. Baraki to weigh in on this. So first off, we'll start with anorexia nervosa. The data here is pretty consistent that individuals with anorexia nervosa tend to have very high levels of cortisol. Now, it's not the same level as Cushing's, so you couldn't just turn up, you know, to a clinic and say, oh, look, you have Cushing's, and it's really anorexia. That's not really the case, but it's still elevated and pretty consistent finding here. The most interesting thing about this is that individuals with anorexia nervosa have low levels of body fat and low or normal blood pressure, whereas individuals with Cushing's disease or Cushing's syndrome almost universally have high levels of body fat and high blood pressure. Both have high levels of cortisol, but from different mechanisms. Austin, is that interesting to you, or are you just like...
It is interesting. It's not something that I would view as clinically actionable, but it just illustrates that things like body fat levels, things like blood pressure are multifactorial. A lot of different things kind of integrate to generate that outside of just absolute extremes derangements. And so given that they don't have extremely deranged, you know, cortisol levels, it's not enough to solely drive the phenotype of gaining a bunch of body fat and driving high blood pressure. But it is interesting for sure.
Yeah. And there was, I kind of went down the rabbit hole of like, hey, what happens when individuals with anorexia nervosa are like treated, you know, like when they regain weight, do they regain weight in a sort of normal proportion of like muscle to fat mass, for example? And it seems like their weight regain is somewhat cushionoid. So like similar to Cushing's disease, meaning they tend to put on a lot more adipose tissue centrally. So face, abdomen, trunk, et cetera, and not as much muscle mass in the periphery, which I thought was interesting. Unfortunately, I was not satisfied by the explanation. Nobody was saying, well, the elevated cortisol levels persist anyway, even after they're adequately treated. That doesn't seem to be the case. But I do wonder if the body's like primed with those, you know, elevated cortisol levels for a long period of time, if that initial sort of period of treatment, if that's really what we're seeing, and then longer term, you see a correction. There were some case reports documenting that, but I don't know if I feel confident saying that that's like the normal experience. Now, with fasting, so we move on here in this low energy availability sort of continuum that we made here. With fasting, again, pretty reliable finding that while people are fasting, cortisol levels tend to go up. This seems to be related to energy mobilization. You need to make sure that the blood sugar is maintained. You need to make sure that you're able to burn enough fat to create energy. And also you need to free up some amino acids to do stuff because you're not eating any. And so the cortisol levels tend to stay increased until the fast is broken. Just as a brief aside, I know I'm doing a lot of asides here, but people promote intermittent fasting as like this, you know, hey, we're going to lower your cortisol levels, your stress. It's like an optimization thing, right? Or like even these like longer term water fasts. And it's like, I think if you monitored your actual endocrine function during these fasts, you would not be happy in what's going on. You might, quote, feel better from whatever sort of, you know, psychological and neuroendocrine sort of thing that's going on. But I think if you actually looked at the levels of various hormones, you would not be stoked on that.
Agree. Yeah. Poor understanding of physiology.
Yeah. Okay. So moving up here on our low energy availability sort of continuum to dieting. Right. And we'll just define dieting as any sort of energy restriction, whether it's modest amount of calories, a couple hundred, or if it's a big deficit. So maybe 1,000 calorie deficit, for example. Pretty much anytime you go on an energy restricted sort of dietary pattern, there's got to be an initial increase in cortisol levels. These tend to go back down to baseline within a couple weeks, even if the diet persists. So there seems to be like this initial bump where it's like, oh, let's get cortisol levels to go up, likely from maybe for energy mobilization. They tend to go back down within a few weeks. Now, most importantly, there's no difference in cortisol levels between a modest deficit, so a few hundred calories, or a very low calorie diet, which creates like a 1,000 calorie deficit or more. And there's no association between cortisol levels and weight loss in the most recent meta-analysis on the topic, meaning that you would not necessarily expect a person with a higher cortisol level during a sort of dietary pattern to have less weight loss or otherwise have a reduced weight loss, for example. In the know-how trial, 786 adults who had achieved a successful weight loss of at least 5% of their starting body weight, their initial BMI, body mass index, was greater than 25. So they lost weight. And basically what they did, the researchers did, was measure their hair cortisol concentration before they lost weight and then after a year. And there was no correlation between hair cortisol levels and subsequent change in body weight or body fat percentage, which I thought was pretty supportive of the previous meta-analysis that basically showed no relationship between weight loss trajectory and cortisol levels. So when it comes to like dietary pattern change and does cortisol play a role in like how much weight somebody's going to lose, I haven't found evidence for that. I know people say this all the time, and invariably when you ask them for evidence, they either don't quote any or there's some sort of mechanism discussion. You know, we're like, oh, well, you just don't understand endocrinology. And I'm like, I mean, that may be true, but I'm more looking for clinical outcome studies where it's shown that, hey, this person, these people with higher cortisol levels, for example, in response to an energy-restricted diet, well, they lose less weight. That doesn't seem to be well supported. Or people with a higher level of cortisol, don't achieve as much successful weight loss. And you don't see that either. So it's like much ado about nothing. That's kind of my interpretation. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's not a variable worth paying attention to for weight loss outcomes.
There you go. Another interesting thing I found was overfeeding versus underfeeding. So this study took 22 healthy adults and looked at what happened to cortisol levels after 10 days of overfeeding them. And then after a 2-week sort of break, they did 10 days of fasting. So participants were initially admitted to a metabolic ward. So they were basically held under lock and key and fed exactly what the researchers wanted them to eat. They had a 10-day high calorie sort of stay in this research facility with an aim of gaining 7% body weight. And then the intake again was strictly controlled. So after completion of this high calorie protocol, this overfeeding study, subjects were discharged home to resume their normal diet for just over 2 weeks. And then they were readmitted for a second 10-day stay where again, they didn't consume any calories. They fasted for 10 days. During the overfeeding study, the overfeeding portion of the study, subject gained an average of 4.6% body weight. And during the 10-day fast, subjects lost an average of 8.9% of their body weight. In both 10-day periods, cortisol increased significantly from baseline, though the size of the increase was about the same between those who were overfeeding and then when they were underfeeding. So there was really no difference. Cortisol levels went up in both cases. Of course, there was a wide range of variability between individuals and their own cortisol levels, and also the amount of weight lost or gained in two different periods. It's the same relationship we've been saying on a number of our podcasts. There was almost a 5x difference in the amount of weight that was gained and a similar amount of variance in the amount of weight lost. And you're like, how is that possible? They all had the same surplus, you know, relative to their body weight, and they all were fasting. You would expect them to all lose a similar amount of body weight, and that wasn't the case at all. Baseline percent body fat as measured by DEXA and inflammatory markers also did not correlate with cortisol changes. So again, to me, cortisol with respect to like weight loss trajectory and weight management is kind of like a nothing sandwich. I don't know. Is that your interpretation?
I wouldn't dismiss it as completely nothing, but rather it's just one player among such a giant complex web.
Yeah.
And just because it's something that we can measure makes people think that it's worth paying a lot of attention to, when it's like, it's just a member of a really complicated system that perturbations in one area lead to, you know, derangements elsewhere and compensations elsewhere and adaptations elsewhere. And so it's a very limited kind of myopic view to just take a snapshot lab level and think it's going to tell you anything. Yeah,
it's cortisol and potassium. That's it. And magnesium. Yeah. So that's all you need. With respect to body fat, this was interesting that there's a U-shaped relationship between cortisol and BMI. So people with low BMIs in the underweight category tend to have higher cortisol levels. And then people with obesity, for example, also have elevated cortisol levels. And then the sort of bottom of the U tends to be centered right around that BMI of 25. And so if you read this and you went no further, you'd say, look, man, BMI is bullshit. I should just have an overweight BMI and I would have the lowest level of cortisol. Like if that's what you read, you know. But the problem here is that it's like an artifact of the sort of population that's being sampled. Those with really low BMIs tend to be those who are pretty sick in general. Mm-hmm. And so what that is doing is effectively skewing where the U is in relationship to the BMI. So I would not suspect that achieving an overweight BMI is going to be health promoting for most people. I'm not saying that it's going to be harming, you know, particularly if that's about a bunch of muscle mass, but I don't know that we should strive for an overweight BMI just to get like a lower level of cortisol. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that sounds really stupid if somebody has that idea. So,
yeah. Now, this is where things went a little sideways with respect to hunger. So it's been pretty well characterized that during acute stress, appetite is typically suppressed, whereas chronic stress generally promotes wanting, seeking, and intake of very tasty foods. So hyperpalatable, high fat, added sugar, energy dense foods that are not particularly filling or satiating. So there's some mechanistic sort of support for this. So corticotropin releasing hormone from the hypothalamus, that's basically what the first thing that happens when your body senses stress. Well, that tends to suppress appetite at the level of the brain, likely through inhibiting this appetite promotion hormone called neuropeptide Y. Neuropeptide Y in general stimulates appetite, and then corticotropin releasing hormone or CRH tends to inhibit that. So when you're, you know, running from a predator, for example, and cortisol levels are higher, yeah, you're not typically that hungry. We think that's mediated at least in part by corticotropin releasing hormone or CRH that's released from the hypothalamus. However, once that CRH gets to the anterior pituitary gland, the anterior pituitary gland spits out ACTH. That ACTH gets to the adrenal gland, it pumps out a bunch of cortisol. Well, cortisol levels are a little bit elevated, and that tends to stimulate intake of food if it's persistently elevated. So the effects of chronic stress on food intake and weight may be related to these sort of perturbations in that hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, likely from cortisol. So it's like a downstream sort of effect. And again, this is likely highly variable amongst individuals, not only in their cortisol response, but their sensitivity to that cortisol response and what else is happening at the level of the brain. Because again, as you mentioned earlier, this is just a complex system. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you're just going to focus on one particular like neuroendocrine pathway, yeah, you're just missing it. There's more stuff going on here. Last thing I'll talk about here is in relationship to bariatric surgery. There's a number of studies that have investigated like pre-surgery cortisol levels and if that predicts someone's success from bariatric surgery. And the only finding that was pretty consistent, but not on all studies, but a number of them, was that higher pre-surgery cortisol levels tended to be predictive of individuals who would regain greater than 10% of their initial body weight. We don't know the mechanism necessarily, but that might just be one sort of indicator on who's likely to be more successful. But again, I wouldn't chalk that up just to cortisol. I suspect that if you tested enough other things, you would find a constellation of findings that are maybe more characteristic of individuals who are likely to regain weight. So maybe there's some sort of like weight regain phenotype, you know, and you could say, well, they have higher cortisol levels, they have lower levels of, you know, satiety hormones and such, and you just find that sort of relationship. But at present, that currently hasn't been identified. Any other thoughts with respect to like dietary pattern, weight loss, nutrition, and cortisol levels other than you think it's a TWD?
Yeah, I think it's not something that's worth measuring or worrying about, but I'm certainly glad it's there in the context of all sorts of dietary changes, right? Because you mentioned that it's useful and plays a really important role in like maintaining energy availability, for example. So like you don't die if you don't eat. And part of the reason why is because cortisol helps you to maintain your like blood glucose levels, for example, right? So it is a really important player in this kind of metabolic space, but not one that you should strive to actively manipulate directly like that number, right? Instead, if you're doing generally the right things, then you can just trust that your adrenals and HPA axis are doing what they're supposed to do, which is the case for a lot of these hormones.
Yeah, it's kind of like gut health, right? You're like, yeah, we know gut health is important, you know, but as far as like measuring it and then like doing something directly to it in order to achieve better health or performance outcomes, that's more of a shoulder shrug outside of the things that we would generally recommend for health promotion and performance promotion that have nothing to do with the gut directly. They just kind of like work indirectly.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. Last section of this podcast, we're going to talk about exercise and its effect on cortisol. So there's this view by some in the space that increases in cortisol from exercise can lead to catabolism in the body. So protein breakdown, tissue breakdown, et cetera, which results in muscle loss and other undesirable effects relating to exercise adaptation. Now, this is an oversimplification, in my view, of the hormonal actions of cortisol. So we're going to talk about those here. So cortisol levels from intensive, prolonged exercise are not nearly to the same level as those found in patients with Cushing's syndrome, like our last case, not the case we reviewed earlier today, but our last case. So cortisol levels were examined in physically active men at rest, and then after intensive, prolonged exercise. They did 85 minutes of exercise at 75% of their VO2 max and compared that to Cushing's patients at rest. So at rest, the average cortisol level, these are just numbers. You don't need to know the units. You don't need to know anything about the scale. These are just numbers, all right, for you to like relate to one another. At rest, the average cortisol level is about 350, okay, in these non-Cushing's patients. The peak level during exercise to exhaustion was about 700 and went down back to baseline by about 90 minutes afterwards. Okay, so resting 350 effectively doubled during this exhaustive exercise for about 90 minutes, and then an hour and a half later, it was back down to baseline. Meanwhile, individuals with Cushing's, their level is 900 and it stays there all day, every day until they're sort of treated, right? So when you're thinking about exercise, oh, could this cause hypercortisolism? And it's like, nah, dude, flash in the pan, it jumps up a little bit, all right, not to the level that we see in Cushing's disease, and it goes right back down. And we'll talk about why. During exercise, the physiological stress and the anticipation thereof helps to mobilize energy and respond to challenging environmental, physical, and external, or even internal psychosocial stimuli. So when you initiate exercise, your fight or flight system, your sympathetic nervous system kicks on. And effectively, that activation stimulates the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And so, yeah, you're going to get more cortisol and more catecholamines. That's the catecholamines being noradrenaline, adrenaline, and a little bit of dopamine. This is mostly used, as we've talked about before, for energy liberation, energy mobilization. So in fat, you break down stored triglycerides in the fat tissue to free fatty acids that your mitochondria can use to create energy. In muscle, you break down protein into amino acids. The catabolic changes in muscle produce more free tyrosine and a breakdown product of myosin and actin called 3-methylhistidine. But these levels actually are not very elevated in active muscle tissue. So most of that accumulation in muscle catabolism from cortisol happens in non-active muscle tissue. And it's thought that this is like a defense mechanism against degradation of muscles that you're apparently using. And you go back to our research review from a couple episodes ago where it's like, oh, you could actually like shift hypertrophy or muscle mass from different areas of the body. Perhaps this is one of the mechanisms that's involved. Now, if you're taking glucocorticoids like prednisone, for example, for a long time, particularly high doses, you get systemic degradation of muscles, muscle catabolism. Effectively, you can't protect against that, which is why muscle wasting and muscle loss is such a severe side effect that we watch out for. But even though the catabolic actions of cortisol lead to this expanded free amino acid pool, evidence suggests that enhanced contractile activity during exercise defends muscle tissue from an exaggerated level of catabolism and spares those skeletal muscle proteins from degradation. Also, this may be a related mechanism is that during exercise training, the affinity of muscle androgen receptors for glucocorticoids decreases. That just means that cortisol can't bind to its receptor or to the muscle androgen receptor as readily. And that's thought to facilitate more testosterone binding to those androgen receptors to basically enhance the anabolic actions of testosterone and reduce the catabolic actions of cortisol. And then finally in the liver, as far as energy liberation goes, you're breaking down more glucose that you have stored. So that's glycogenolysis. You're breaking down glycogen and you're also making more blood sugars. So that's gluconeogenesis. You also get a stimulation of making these more catecholamines, like we said earlier. That's noradrenaline and adrenaline. And as far as how much cortisol is elevated, that's typically related to training load. So as intensity goes up, as volume goes up, and this is all related to your current fitness level, cortisol levels tend to go up during exercise. It tends to go up for about the first 20 or 30 minutes when you start exercise. But if you only exercise for about an hour, it actually returns to baseline by the time you're done. Interestingly, when you prolong exercise for maybe 2 hours, for example, trained individuals will actually get a second increase in cortisol levels. This seems to be related to a muscle-specific sort of metabolite that you're creating during exercise. We think it might be IL-6 or some other sort of muscle-specific chemical, a myokine that is released during exercise. And this is most pronounced in very trained individuals, meaning like if you're very fit and very well trained, you can kind of keep going compared to an untrained individual who, when they're tested after prolonged exercise, they can't generate another cortisol response. And again, if you were just thinking like high cortisol, bad, lower cortisol, good, you would say, well, if you can't generate another cortisol response, that's probably pretty good. And Austin and I are both over here like, no, that's dangerous. That's bad. You wouldn't want that.
I wonder how much that, I mean, it's obviously going to be multiple factors, but you know, when you see, endurance athletes with their kick at the end of races and things like that, if there's, that's one part of the symphony that leads to one athlete having a much stronger and maybe able to hold on to their kick a bit longer at the end of an endurance race to beat out the competition, that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, there was a study. So basically they did a 10-minute power test prior to the prolonged exercise. And then they did a 2-hour run. And then they did that 10-minute test again at the end after the 2-hour run, all right? And then they measured cortisol levels in these individuals, all right? So 6 individuals had higher cortisol levels in the second test compared to the first 10-minute test. And the other 6 individuals had lower cortisol levels or no change in cortisol levels on the second test, right? When you looked at the actual anaerobic power that was measured, it was much higher in those who were able to re-elevate their cortisol levels, suggesting that there's maybe this sort of like resetting via suppressed endocrine function in those who are untrained. They're like, look, man, your body can't handle this. We're not giving you all this extra energy. Sorry. So that was a pretty interesting study I found on this. All right. So, all right. We mobilized some energy. We made some catecholamines. We know that cortisol levels are, they correspond with training load. We know that it goes up for the first 20 to 30 minutes and goes back down to baseline unless you're have prolonged exercise sessions, in which case the ability to generate that second cortisol response seems to be adaptive. There doesn't seem to be a lot of difference between conditioning and lifting, meaning that the relationship is kind of the same. It's intensity and volume dependent. The higher intensity, the higher the volume, In general, the more cortisol is going to be produced during the exercise session is proportional, okay? It does seem to be a little higher in conditioning exercise compared to resistance training, and that's thought to be due to the prolonged continual activity rather than the resting that happens with resistance training. There's been a few studies. They've tried to investigate cortisol responses with shortened rest periods, for example, and they tend to have a cortisol response that looks a lot more like the conditioning efforts overall. I think one of the reasons why cortisol level has become this sort of like, I don't know, hormone of interest in exercise really dates back to the 80s. There was like this testosterone to cortisol ratio that was being used to sort of monitor training load in individuals. It was thought that a free testosterone to cortisol ratio decrease of more than 30% would be like a critical alteration in hormonal status. But this was not like widely supported. It was just like an idea that these researchers came up with based on monitoring of a small group of athletes. But it was like, when it was repeated to sort of see like, hey, does this carry over? No, it has not been consistently shown. Even in individuals who were like, they were trying to overtrain them, trying to overreach them. And actually a decreased ratio correlated with improved performance in a number of studies, meaning like the exact opposite was found. So to me, it just seems like, yeah, you can measure those hormones, but it doesn't seem to reliably like predict performance. And so why would you, other than just to have numbers?
Yeah, it's like an adorably simplistic concept if you look at it in retrospect. You're like, testosterone, good. Cortisol, bad. I want one to go up, the other to go down. It's like, really?
Yeah. So after exercise, cortisol levels, again, they return to baseline within about 90 minutes after you finish training. During that period, it's really inhibiting sort of immune system response. And then again, there's some like tissue level changes in sensitivity and like response to cortisol. Ultimately, that's why you get an elevation in muscle protein synthesis despite the elevated cortisol levels, because at the level of the muscle tissue themselves, specifically the active muscles, they're more sensitive to testosterone than they are to cortisol. As far as the initial response, like why does cortisol level go up when you start exercise? It seems to be threshold mediated, meaning like not every activity that you will do requires cortisol to go up. It has to like count as exercise. And this is one question I've been trying to answer, like what sort of intensity or marker or metric can we use where like this is definitively exercise? And so you get the benefits associated with exercise versus this is just physical activity. Hmm. And like, is it worth drawing a line in the sand about that? And so it seems like cortisol only starts to kick in or go up once it's challenging enough. And it seems to be at about 50% of the heart rate that's associated with your VO2 max, which is coincidentally what some authors have used to define the bottom of zone one in that five zone model of conditioning. There's not a lot of evidence on this. This is a lot of speculation. I don't feel comfortable saying that that's the case, but it does seem like it follows to me that if whatever activity or physical task that you're doing is not hard enough to require you to like your body to say, look, dude, we need more energy on board and we need more catecholamines on board. We need our sympathetic nervous system to be going. Then why would your cortisol levels go up, right? That's like if you're taking a stroll around the block and it's not that exhausting for you. So that seems to make sense. Also, this seems to be variable in response to people's fitness level. The fitter you get, the less cortisol you release during exercise proportionally, unless the thing gets harder, mm-hmm. right? So I would actually be really interested to look at a longitudinal study where they had people, I don't know, start a barbell medicine prescription, you know, beginner prescription, right? And they're untrained at first. What's their cortisol level right after they train on week one? And then they keep training for a year, and a year later, they're doing a similar program, maybe just a little bit more volume. What's their cortisol level then? Would you predict, Dr. Baraki, that if they progressively loaded everything, so not only the weights, it's the same level of hardness, volume, same level of hardness, everything, do they have the same cortisol response, or is it lower because now they're habituated to that sort of training? What do you think?
Completely made up speculation. I think it'd probably be in a similar range. I don't know that you would be able to reliably differentiate them, especially within the limitations of the test. But even if you had a perfectly accurate test, I think it'd be more or less similar. That would be the whole point of progressively loading, right? And similar to like lactate thresholds that would go up as, you know, your fitness goes up at a given heart rate.
You just have to do it at a faster pace to get the same sort of lactate production. Yeah. Exactly. I suspect because they'd be lifting heavier absolute weights, they'd be doing more volume in general. They'd, you know, the total sort of stress experience would be about the same. You'd get the same level of, you know, cortisol release are about the same. But they could go longer. And so then maybe you would get a higher level. But if they did the first workout that they ever did, it'd probably be lower.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that'd be like us going in and squatting 100 pounds or something, right?
It's like, sounds awesome.
I mean,
sounds awesome.
Yeah.
So overall here, while many have speculated that exercise results in a quote high cortisol state, either transiently due to acute exercise or chronically due to overtraining, and that the state can induce harmful effects in lifters, there's no real evidence for these claims in normally trained or even overtrained athletes who are at risk of overtraining syndrome. And there's been multiple studies that have actually tried to investigate this. So let's wrap this up, Dr. Baraki. Cortisol is a steroid hormone that's produced in the adrenal glands that sit on top of the kidneys. Cortisol levels change throughout the day, having both circadian and ultradian rhythms. For the circadian rhythm, cortisol typically peaks in the morning. For most people, it's around 8 a.m., and it decreases to its lowest point, its nadir, right around bedtime or 10 p.m. Now, the ultradian rhythm is layered on top of this, where there are about 8 to 10 pulsatile peaks of cortisol over the course of the day. That's mostly used for fine-tuned control of cortisol because it has a ton of functions in the body. Now, many are concerned about having excess or high cortisol levels, but that's not generally something that happens from normal stress, specifically from diet or exercise. Now, real cortisol excess is called Cushing syndrome, which is defined as a prolonged increase in cortisol levels that is not due to a normal physiological response to stress. Now, why are we talking about this? Well, many are concerned about having excess or high levels of cortisol, but that's not something that generally happens outside of an actual medical condition, specifically not from dieting or from exercise. Now, real cortisol excess is called Cushing's syndrome, which is defined as a prolonged increase in cortisol levels that are not due to a normal physiological response to stress. The signs and symptoms of Cushing's syndrome result directly from chronic exposure to excess glucocorticoid, in most cases, excess cortisol. Now, they vary by patient due to the degree and the duration of excess cortisol, as well as the cause. Main symptoms include elevated blood sugar, muscle weakness and wasting due to excess protein catabolism, immunosuppression, high blood pressure, weight gain, and also mood disorders. Now, evaluation of the cause and treatment typically requires a medical professional, such as an endocrinologist. And there are many ways to test cortisol levels, including many that are available directly to the consumer. But we do not recommend these, nor do we recommend working up cortisol levels on your own. Now, with respect to nutrition and body composition, the relationship between cortisol and weight management is not as simple as advertised. Yes, there's some evidence that pre-operative cortisol levels may predict the tendency to regain weight after metabolic surgery or bariatric surgery, but otherwise, cortisol levels don't seem to reliably predict weight loss from diet and exercise. Now, both excess and insufficient dietary intake, as measured by body fat, well, both of those seem to elevate cortisol levels. There's a U-shaped relationship between BMI and cortisol levels. Still, both small and large energy deficits that reduce body fat to a normal, healthy level do not seem to do much to cortisol. Yes, cortisol is likely involved in appetite and satiety and variations thereof, which are mostly genetically predetermined. Well, that might stymie some weight loss in some individuals, and it may compromise appetite for weight gain in others. Now, with respect to exercise, exercise elevates cortisol for the purpose of catecholamine and energy production. Elevations in cortisol are typically short-lived and generally lower than what is seen in hypercortisolism or Cushing syndrome. They tend to return to baseline in hours after exercise is over, and also cortisol levels are reduced in people who do daytime exercise on average. Cortisol levels seem to be trainable in individuals. They tend to get lower as people become better trained, and there's a preserved cortisol response when needed during prolonged strenuous activity. Overall, cortisol is super important for health, but in our opinion, it's not really worth measuring, managing, or stressing about outside of frank insufficiency or deficiency.
Well summarized. Very detailed. A lot of work.
Very mindful. Very demure. That's right. All right. That is a wrap here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, episode 313. Thanks to Dr. Austin Baraki for sharing his time with us as we discussed hypercortisolism. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. For everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Hey guys, before we get into the podcast, I wanted to let you know that we're launching Barbell Medicine Plus so that we can expand on what we're doing with the podcast, the website, and beyond. Now, over the past 300 plus episodes, Dr. Baraki and I have tried our best to be one of your go-to resources for legit, evidence-based health and fitness information. But now, with your help, we want to do more. Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers will enjoy ad-free listening and for nearly all of our episodes, receive access to an executive summary and an article, along with the transcript, a video version of the podcast, and exclusive access to a private forum to ask Dr. Baraki and I questions, which we'll answer on a monthly podcast that's released only to our subscribers. We'll be publishing other exclusive content for Plus members as well, and we've already uploaded a lot of resources for our subscribers and will continue to expand this offering. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. Thank you in advance for your support. Let's get into the episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.